Almighty and Eternal Father, again we come into Thy presence. We thank Thee that You have given unto us Thy Word, that You have given unto us also Thy Spirit to bear witness unto the truth, that we with Thy household and Thy children can know Thy purposes and Thy plans. And out of the oracle of Thy Word and under the inspiration of Thy Spirit shall we see and catch the vision of Thy purpose in the earth, for Thy household and the nations which must emerge forth out of Thy household. Thankful that You have fulfilled Thy covenants, and that we were Thy children and can say, Our Father which art in heaven, know that we are the children of eternity, know that we are the possessors of spirit and life which is emerged forth from Thee, that You have given us eternal life and we shall never perish. We thank Thee for the realization the nation of which we are a part, which is our heritage, is a great nation in Thy hand to accomplish Thy work. Grant unto us an understanding of Thy Word, that we might be able to make known unto people the great destiny of Thy household and of our peoples. Awaken Thy people out of their sleep. Cause them to resist the influences of those forces that would seek to direct them in ways of error, that would seek to reduce us to slavery and destroy the greatness of our nation. We pray, our Father, Thy blessing to rest upon the spiritual center of Thy kingdom, Thy church, upon the nations of Thy kingdom in this hour. As we look out over these things which are before us, grant unto us the vision that is essential for each one of us to carry forward our responsibility and bring in Thy kingdom in the hour of its greatness. And so as we commit ourselves to Thy hand, we say, Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thine we ask it. Amen. Returning this afternoon in our discussion of the destiny of the nations, especially as this relates unto us in one of the great turbulent periods of human history. Throughout this week, we have had the experience of hearing the reports of the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, spending much time together with the members of the Cabinet trying to find a solution to the problems of the world, and discussing situations that concern great trouble and great problem, and no one questions that the world's in great trouble. Nor did we hear the solution to this trouble emerge from these two men. For as they discussed the problems and the troubles, some of the things that were suggested would not be a solution. But do not think for a moment, because we hear these words coming out of leaders of these nations, that out of their decisions will the destiny of the world be decided. That's one of the reasons why, as children of the Most High, we can understand what it is that is going to happen in the earth, and we're going to see a lot of opinions ruled and overruled in the earth. For the nations of God's kingdom will survive. When we understand the background behind our race and behind the nations which have emerged from it, we will recognize that God Almighty has a great and tremendous purpose for His nations in the earth, that shall never be overthrown and never be destroyed by the powers of darkness in the world today. A week ago, we were talking about the events around the crucifixion of Christ. And one of those events which stood out was the remarkable loyalty of both those that were the disciples of Christ to the principles of carrying forward the truth of His resurrection after they had realized this. Among one who had been loyal, though, before that resurrection was Joseph of Arimathea. And this man played a very unusual part as it relates to the background of your culture and your race. For Joseph of Arimathea was the uncle of Mary and the great uncle of Christ, really, by direct relationship. And he was a man of great means and of great influence. As we know, he was one of the Essenes. He is also a member of the Sanhedrin and was known to be a man of honesty and of great determination to see that the program of the kingdom advanced, and had put forth much of his own wealth in trying to develop what would be the accepting of Christ as the Messiah and bringing about the necessary equipment and manpower and conditions to bring about his coronation. And there was a great impact of grief that descended upon Joseph of Arimathea when he saw these plans apparently break, and when he saw the crucifixion of Christ take place. And he went, as you know, to Pontius Pilate, and he offered him a pearl of very great price and said, I want the permission to bury the body of Christ. I want to put him in my own tomb, which has been prepared for me. So it was that Christ was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. But when the Jews heard this and knew what had happened, they decided to do something about it, and so they imprisoned Joseph. And they were going to try him for this act on the first day of the week after they'd gotten past the hours of the Passover. And of course, one of the great significant records which lies in Rome today is that in that great hour, in the magnitude of Christ's resurrection, when even the graves gave forth some of their dead, again in a second sign of the miracle of the hour, Joseph was also brought forth out of prison by the shattering opening of the prison cell, and Joseph was joined with Christ and was seen with him after this in Galilee. And that's one of the reports which Pontius Pilate was later to tell in Rome when he told about the incidents that surrounded the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ, and how Joseph of Arimathea, who was a man of great means and known throughout Rome's empire, and one who had buried Christ in his own tomb, and how they had seized him and they had decided that they would try him and charge him with treason against the state of Jewry and its own Sanhedrin in its courts. Well, strangely enough, in the hours that followed Christ's resurrection, with the dynamic demonstration of miracle and of the strange events that transpired, they no longer tried to capture Joseph until the church started to move in the days that followed Pentecost. And in those days that followed Pentecost, they recruited again their own militant forces and sought to always have it led by an Israelite from some portion of the provinces or one that they could use to this extent. That's why the Apostle Paul, who was an Israelite of the tribe of Benjamin that had unfortunately been taken in by the sect of Jews, but did not consider himself, of course, one by race, and having come from no mean city, the city of Tarsus, he had never had the experience of having met Christ until that unusual event that happened when he was on the road to Damascus with a commission leading Jewish armies to persecute Christians. Joseph of Arimathea and Mary, the mother of Christ, and also Mary and Martha, the sisters of Lazarus, and Lazarus whom Christ had called out of the tomb, and who the Jews seriously and constantly tried to put to death again. And here the gospel tells us that after the resurrection of Lazarus, they were seeking Lazarus' life that they might put him to death again. But their desire to destroy them never stopped. And of course, there was also Marcellus and Romulus, both of these having been Romans who were disciples of Christ among those that followed him and strong friends of the powerful patrician Joseph of Arimathea. And so the pressure was on, and the court of the Sanhedrin had met secretly, and none of the Pharisees would sit with it. Gamaliel alone demanding the right to intervene in cases that involved Pharisees, and they planned that they were going to secretly have Joseph and Mary and Martha and Mary, the sister of Lazarus, and all of those who were of this company, set adrift in high seas. This was their plan, and they were going to have this carried out by some nomads who they were to deliver them to captive. Well, Joseph of Arimathea heard about this, and he fitted out one of his great ships. And on that ship he put much of his wealth and of the things of great value to him. And he took Mary, and he took Mary and Martha and Lazarus and Romulus and Marcellus and his own household, and he set sail. And he went out through the Mediterranean Sea and out past Gibraltar and on up the coast of Europe to the place wherein he had his own great holdings. And one of the things which is most significant in the part of that biblical record and is something for us to remember is that he was headed for Britain, and he was headed especially for Glastonbury. For here in Britain had been one of the areas where Joseph owned many hides of land. In fact, the whole site of modern Glastonbury in Britain had belonged to Joseph of Arimathea. It had been during the time of before Christ started his ministry, between his 19th and 20th year, that Christ had sailed on the ship of Joseph of Arimathea to Britain, and there he had been taken by Joseph to the various universities of Britain. Now, there were actually 40 universities of Britain, all of which are still existent, whose names are traced back to their ancient names even at that time. There's only 7 of them that exist today that can't be traced back to the ancient universities. For even Julius Caesar said of Britain that it was a land of universities, of philosophy, of culture, of law, and of poetry. And he said concerning it that he was most amazed in his visit when he had gone to Britain, instead of finding there barbarians, as they had been told they would be, who was always retreating before his armies with a logistical skill that was quite unusual. And Rome, in several attempts, had tried to conquer Britain, and each time they found the people would retreat before them. And because of the heavy equipment which they used, why, they would set out and build strong Appian-type roads of rock and of mortar. And always the Britons would retreat until they felt that the amount of the tax and the amount of the road building was about even. And then they would pay the tax and the Romans would go home, and they felt that they had just paid for some roads and that was all. A few years later, they wouldn't pay any taxes and the Romans would come back and they would retreat all over Britain, and more roads were built, and those roads are there today. And finally, Julius Caesar realized that he was tricked, and he went up himself to visit the peoples of Britain. And of course, Rufus was the king, and Aristarchus had been the king previous. And when he came, he said that he was amazed to see these great universities, their fine stone buildings, the palaces that were on Britain. And when he saw this barbarian king, he came well dressed in the finest of materials. And when he came to speak to him, why, he said, of course, he said, I thought that he was a barbarian. He couldn't speak Latin. And when he came to talk to the king of England, who couldn't speak Latin, he said, he then surprised me, for he spoke most beautiful classical Greek. He said, I realized that in the Academy of the Lyceum in Greece, they did not speak Greek with any greater purity than he did. And he had the emperor of Rome at a disadvantage because he wasn't quite as great a linguist of Greek as this. The fact remains that in that day, all of these universities of Britain taught classical Greek, and all of its scholars taught Greek as well as they taught the varying tongues of their peoples in the ancient basic languages which they had had. What's significant about this, then, the hour that he talked with the king, and then just as he was about to go, the king turned to England and talked with him with such beautiful Latin that Julius Caesar was embarrassed, because he could have talked to him in Latin all the time, and the barbarian was no barbarian at all. And so Julius Caesar said the thing that was mystifying was that these peoples, whose religion also exists with great antiquity, and from what they tell me, their religion has been founded here for several thousand years. And this, he said, I cannot understand. Well, let us take a look again at the picture. It was to this land that Joseph of Arimathea was going. Why? He not only owned those hides of land, but the cousin of Mary, another cousin than the one Elizabeth, who was married to Zacharias, the priest, who was the father of John the Baptist, was Anna. And Anna was married to Rufus, the king of the Britons. And the unique thing about it was that Christ, as the son of Mary, was related to the line from whence most of the Welsh stock came in the land of Britain. The most significant thing about this was that these people were very much interested, of course, in the teachings of Christ when he was there. And it was a matter of record that he taught in every, the masters from all of their universities who came, and they said, this truly must be our Messiah, even though he stands in youth, because the Druids had a long and ancient doctrine. And that doctrine of the Druids was the background of most of the theology of almost all of the peoples of Central Europe. And while it was referred to as pagan by some, it actually believed in a god of spirit who controlled the whole universe, who had put it all together out of the energy which he had created out of the capacities of his own mind and his own thought. They believed that God not only existed in spirit, but the great triad of his being was spirit, soul, and body. The body of deity they called Jesu, and they called the name of deity Jesu in Britain 1,000 years before the coming of Christ to the Isle of Britain. And it was no hard task for them to accept that Jesus, which was a later British term for Jesu in Druidry, and was also the name which they took from the Apostles Paul writing to the peoples inside of Greece, and he used the words for the all highest God embodied as Savior, and that was Yah Zeus, and Jesus and Jesu, and the peoples who had the Druidic background in Britain, and the Franks and the Goths and the peoples of Scandinavia, for even Woden and Odin were the names of princes of Britain who became leaders in Scandinavia, and later the traditions built around them had almost deified them until the coming of Christianity. The rather unique thing about this was that when Joseph of Arimathea arrived, the first thing which he did, his ship was shipwrecked on the coast of France, and this had been one of the unusual adventures in his experience. And he then secured another ship, and they sailed past the white cliffs of Dover. And when he came to England, it was Joseph of Arimathea who went straight to his 12 hides of land, and he took with him Mary and Lazarus, who entered into his service. And he built there a great Christian mission which exists, and because of this, the King of England set aside the fact that no church property inside of British territory would have to pay taxes. And it's one of the first matters of record that he exempted taxes on the mission in the church with the 12 tithes of land that was built by Joseph of Arimathea when he had to flee from Jerusalem for his life because of his stand for Christ and because he had let Christ use his tomb. And of course he brought with him Mary, who's buried in Glastonbury and whose tomb can be seen in Glastonbury this time. Lazarus also. Lazarus, who many wondered, what happened to Lazarus? Lazarus raised from the dead. Lazarus, who the Jews tried to put to death again. And Lazarus lived some 40 years thereafter, serving in the early Christian churches, preaching up and down Britain, as did also Romulus and also Marcellus. In fact, daughter of the cousin of Mary, whose name was also Claudia, went down to Rome, and there she married Rufus, a senator who was a very brilliant senator and a friend of the peoples of Britain in the Roman Senate. And family was so well liked that even Caesar himself gave them special operative ability to move in and out of not only Rome and Britain, but when there was trouble in Britain, he always used this family. And, of course, the rest of that family, including Pudens and several others. You will remember that when Paul was in Rome and he was a prisoner, that many times during the 6 years interval of his trial, why, he would come and go from Rome. He'd go to other places, and he went up to Britain. He went to Spain, and he always sent his special felicitations to the royal family. And he sent it by this family who he stays with and who he refers to in his epistles. I think that it's most significant to realize that the antiquity of this event, it was the Apostle Paul who appointed the first bishop of Rome. And by the way, that was not Peter. Peter had been in Britain and Peter had been in all Gaul. And he came eventually to become one of the apostles with a bishopric to Rome. And there he was teaching in the catacombs at the time that he was caught and crucified head downward. But he was not the first bishop of Rome, and he didn't build the first Roman church. But the first church that had been built on the continent had been built by the hands of Christ, and the second one had been built by Joseph of Arimathea. And we are told from the history now of Canterbury that some of its own masters and its own students joined with Christ to erect that first house to Yahweh in the Isles of Britain. And their knowledge of their antiquity is one of the great prides of the ancient universities of that land. For when God was calling Abraham out of the land of the Ur of the Chaldees, there were descendants of the house of Enoch, who were of the children of Seth and the house of Adam, that were then settling in Britain, that built the first Stonehenge. And that's the reason why the artifacts of that time under radiocarbon go back so far. In fact, we could tell you today that we have in the process now of consummation the entire pattern of the king lines, as well as the households that deal with not only all of the peoples of white Western Europe, but there is not a branch of Western Europe today which are not tied into the house of Israel or to the Sethite migrations that had even preceded the calling of Abraham. And thus fused in Britain were the peoples that dated back to the old days of Enoch, and in that hour those that had migrated had a whole theology, and that theology may be referred to by some as having gone downhill to a given point and then came back up when Christianity touched Britain. But Druidry was the foundation of that faith, which reached way back unto the knowledge and the teachings of Enoch and back to the promises which had been made in the days of Seth and even unto Adam. And the language which we find involving all of the peoples of the ancient Saki and the Scythians and all of the house of Dan is so filled, of course, as we know, with Hebrew that it never lost any of its great significance. The words and the terms and the meanings are still carrying through into your language today until the basic factor in the Anglo-Saxon tongue that we call English is the ancient Hebrew meanings. And again, the word Hebrew is so significant to us as a background for some knowledge concerning the nations of Western Europe. For the word Heber in itself is of great significance. For the word Heber, as a descendant of Shem, and from whom almost all of the great strength of the white race today has emerged, is in itself classical. And today, virtually not one individual that's known as a Jew anywhere in the world has descended from Shem, and by no stretch of the imagination should be called a Hebrew. And because they are not Hebrews, there is no reason why people should be shying from the word Hebrew, but they should understand this. That as the word Shem, they are not Shemites, and the word anti-Semitism is one of the most foolish words in all the tongues of men. Because the word anti-Semite would be anti-descendant of Shem and would be against all the peoples of the white race, Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Nordic, Basque, and Lombard, when actually the word anti-Semitism doesn't mean that in the thinking of men. But really, it means anti-Jewish, which in turn is Canaanite, Hittite, Amalekite, and Khazar. So under these factors, we have a pattern entirely different from the intended meanings. When we go back to the pattern of this history in its antiquity, the Franks and the Normans and the interchange of thrones that took place for some 1,400 years carry us back to an origin of a people whose history is so important to us all. Because all of the white race have emerged out of the same stock of the house of Israel. Of course, to most of you, you well know that the 10 tribes that were carried away in the days of Sennacherib and endured and were released under Shalmaneser's climactic reign and came through the Caucasus to settle, there were some of these tribes who had emerged in the Caucasus even in the 3rd century. Some of Benjamin had never gone back to move under the administration of the forces that were then pushing. And some of Benjamin never did go back with Judah to the land of Palestine, even for the rebuilding that was to take place, and stayed in Asia Minor and made their journeys to the north. And they were the earliest movement of Benjamin in this direction. The tribe of Dan that had left very, very early because of disturbances of the empire had started to mark their way all over the map of Europe from Danube and Dniester and Dan's land, Denmark, and many other things which people do not realize were tied to the house of Dan. Dan was early in the Isles of Britain and early had an interchange of commerce as well as in background relationship, moved into traffic with the peoples on the Isles even before the house of Joseph was to finally arrive there with Anglo-Saxonum and great numbers of the tribes of Israel. The peoples of Issachar, which had moved into Central Europe and pushed their way northward, settled Finland and was one of the oldest and most sturdy and permanent stocks in that land. The peoples we call Iberians are largely moved into the area known as Spain, and this was a great portion of the house of Simeon, and Simeon resided in Spain in the earliest migrations after they came into Europe. And in fact, the Apostle Paul knows they're Israelites, and when he's talking about the place he's going to go, he talks about all of the people that he was going to greet the side of Rome, and then he makes a statement concerning some of his journeys, and he said, I'm going over to talk to the peoples who I'm going to visit in Spain, and he refers to the peoples in Spain that he's going to visit as Israelites and as the children of God. And so the Apostle Paul knew the Romans, who he addresses as elect, and the peoples of Spain he addresses as elect. And the Spirit expressly, he said, forbade me to go to Asia. The only place I could go were to go to the peoples of the house of Israel. After all, that's understandable, because the Most High God had given these instructions when he said to his disciples over here in the 15th chapter of Matthew, in the 24th verse, he said, I'm not sent. This is Christ himself speaking. I'm not sent but unto the lost tribes or the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And with this declaration, we note that talking to his disciples concerning what they're to do, he says, don't go to the cities of the pagans. And the word translated here, Gentile, is not the same word for Athenos, but the pagans. Don't go to the pagans, but go rather only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And he sent them forth in this manner to build the kingdom. And the Apostle Paul said, the Spirit expressly forbade me to go to Asia. But he went to Rome, and he went to Britain, and he went to Spain, and he traveled throughout portions of Europe. And we have the record today of the Apostle Paul and of the travel of other of the apostles throughout the nations of the Western world. We know today where those nations have gone by their heraldry and by their identity. And there could be no question today of the fact that the nations of Western Europe are not made up of a great conglomerate, mongrelized group. But today the great design among nations of the world is to destroy the influence and the leadership of these great Christian nations of God's kingdom. In fact, if you were to go back to the things that were related to our past history, which to some of you, you are well aware of because of its relationship to prophecy and to the identity and to the message which we have recognized so long as basic in knowledge concerning nations and men. But back in the days of Jeremiah, you'll remember that one of the things that he said he was called to do, he said that I have been called, he said, this day to be set over nations and over kingdoms, to root out some and to pull down others, to destroy, to throw down, to build and to plant. And so Jeremiah, as a prophet of the Most High God, had a lot of work to do, which God had ordained from the very beginning. There's one thing that Jesus said concerning nations. He says, every plant that agronomos, that the God of Spirit did not plant, shall be plucked up by its roots. Every single plant that the Father did not plant, or the deity in its fullness had not ordained and planted, was to be plucked up by its roots. Now we find here again something rather interesting, for in this ancient land, a land of the children of Seth, a land where they had migrated to wilds earlier, a land also that the natural course of travel through the Caucasian Pass into Europe, the liberated Israelites took their course. Scythians that stopped inside of Greece, some of these Scythians found themselves locked in war a little time later with Troy, and yet it's a known fact today that the peoples of Gotae, and a lot of them classified as the old Gotae and Goths, had settled in Troy, and that the Germanic peoples of Troy were none other than the peoples we know today as Judah of the Scriptures, and that Troy's people migrated northward to rejoin and to build houses in Central Europe, where already Goths had been moving out with the Frank houses to which they had been a part. If we go back to the days that of the dispersion of these tribes as they came through the pass and scattered out into Europe, we will note that there were certain groups of them that continued to travel together. And these groups were, by their very affinity, held together even in the map of Europe for some time. France, of course, was mixed up by several groups of people, but predominant forces were to stand out, and the Norman influence in Spain, in France, was to stay for many, many years. Inside of the peoples of the lowlands of Holland and Belgium, the influence of the house of Reuben and the symbols and the knowledge that they are Reuben takes place. In fact, in their songs and in their singing, they used to call themselves Reuben. And they one of the major names for the peoples at that time was the name Reuben and Rachel. And the names of Israel were upon these people throughout those periods of their sojourning. Almost all of the names which were to be used throughout the heart of Central Europe were names that had been used by the peoples of Israel before their migrations. Let's go back to Ireland, ruled over by Heremin in the days when the princess of Jerusalem had been brought there in the great ship of Dan and of Ephraim. For we have the record and tradition of that story, both from Britain as well as from the prophecies in the 17th chapter of Ezekiel, when Jeremiah fulfilled his destiny. For here the Lord said, a great eagle with full of feathers and with divers colors had come unto Lebanon, and he took the highest branch of the cedar, and he cropped off the top of the young twigs, and he carried it to the land of traffic, and he set it in the city of merchants. So the Zedekiah of the house of Judah was carried away captive by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon. And then there was a seed taken out of the land and planted in a fruitful field, and it placed by the great waters and set by the willow trees, and it grew, and it had become a spreading vine of low stature, whose branches turned toward him, and the roots thereof were under him, and it became a vine, and brought forth branches, and shot forth its sprigs. The Scripture tells us concerning this, and thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the highest branch of the high cedar, and I will set it, I will crop it off the top of his young twigs, a tender one, and plant it in a high mountain, or great nation, and eminent, and in the mountain of the height of Israel will I plant it. It shall bring forth boughs, and it shall bear fruit. And it shall be a goodly cedar, and under it shall dwell all the fowl of every wing, and the shadow of the branches thereof shall they dwell. And the bards of ancient England sang about the coming of the princess Tetephi. They talked about the great Viking ship she came on. Its great long beak-like bowsprit was to mark it, and the fleets of Dan and of Ephraim that plied together along the fjords from Scandinavia south into Britain and all the way into the Mediterranean, and the very ships that Jeremiah used to take Tetephi, the daughter of Zedekiah, to save her in that hour when Babylon was seizing all that remained of Israel in Judah and Benjamin. And in that hour he took her on one of these Viking ships that plied the trade. That's why it was referred to as the great eagle. Its great billowing sails, its eagle beak, its great color standards, the diverse colors of its wings, the majesty of what was involved in it was used by the bards of England, who said, "The eagle ship came and carried high the standards of our kings, and upon it was a princess for our king." And it was the story of the coming of Tetefi, married by covenant with the king of Ireland, transplanting the seed line of the house of David through Tetefi again into this house which had been plucked ages ago and transplanted by destiny in the Isle. And from Ireland to Scotland to Wales, we watch the progression of that throne. And tied to that throne is the king and the reigning line of virtually every white Christian nation in Europe during its age of kings, from the Tsar of Russia to the Kaiser of Germany, and to the bloodlines that flowed from Spain to Scandinavia. All of these households and all of this royal family that ruled over the peoples of Britain came out of the seed lines of David's recovenanted, rejoined house. Often I hear the ignorance of division, in which we find one branch of the white race being played off against the other, while we hear them say that these are Assyrians, or these are Ostrogoths that came out of Asia, or these people are not in it because all of Israel was out there in the British Isles. Well, let me tell you, there may be a representation in that court, and there may be families with their bloodline that came from all parts of Israel, but this great house of Anglo-Saxonism that grew up, the sons of Sack, the sons of Isaac, Isaac's sons. One of the oldest words that even before it was ever used in Britain was also used in the heart of Germany and was used all the way north into Saxony. They referred to these white people then as Angli. And the reason why they called white people Angli even themselves is because they were using the word Elohim for gods and children of God. And the Angli, or the word angel, which also comes out of Angli, means the offspring of God. And Angland is the offspring of God's land. In fact, the significance of these situations are tied with the fact that they knew themselves of a common stock, and though they struggled sometimes between one another, the fact remains that today the peoples that make up the Western Christian civilization, of which you are a part, have emerged out of the dispersion and the destiny which God had decreed. And these nations which today stand up in the midst of these events as the great pillars on the horizon, and the United States of America, which has become, again, one nation, while basically moving out under our Anglo background and our original migrations and colonies, yet today this nation has been colonized by people of all of the great rootstock of the white race in Europe, Anglo-Saxon and Scandinavian and Nordic and Germanic. We find here welded together with Basque and Lombard a great and solid nation. One least common denominator, and that is the fact that we have emerged in a common seed line from the Adamic race. One mighty denominator is that our basic faith recognizes that Christ, incarnate deity, is the Lord and Master, and as such is the deity recognized in worship today by every white Western Christian nation on the face of the earth. There are a lot of people that do not think that these things are important, but let me tell you today that all of the revolution that is directed against you and all the problem that faces the nations of the world is an antagonism against the God you serve and against the race who are his children and the civilization under divine law which they represent. It's a desire to rule the world with ruthlessness, to exploit it to its limit, to hold the peoples in slavery. This is the supreme satanic design. There is no question about the fact that there shall never be peace on the earth until the nations which we call white and Christian rule the earth from one end of the earth to the other under the administration of our eternal God. There is no other solution to this. That's the day will come, and it will come being your time, when the name of Yahshua, every knee is going to bow, and they're going to recognize from one end of the earth to the other that Christ was the embodiment of Yahweh, the fullness of deity, walking the earth. That's destiny, and it's the destiny of the nations. Someone said to me, "I think, Dr. Swift, that we're about to be plowed under. We're outnumbered. We have the strangest cabinet that we've ever had in history, and everything they seek to do, they seem to be blundering just a little farther down the road towards destruction, and it looks as like we're all over." In fact, even the Prime Minister of Britain wants to recognize Red China, put her in the United Nations, and that would take away all the balance of power that the Western world has. It would mean that we would never win another decision, that they could change our laws and our customs if that happened. And here the United States representatives say, "Well, we can't do that now because the terms are too serious. because Red China demands that we oust nationalist China, and America wouldn't stand for that. But now maybe if she modified that stand, we'd let her in. And the moment she comes in under any stand, oh, why, this horde of Antichrist would change the voting balance, and we would all of us lose any liberties that we had if we stayed within it. We shouldn't even permit our representatives to say, well, now maybe we'll do it if, because there should be no ifs on joining ourselves to any of the pagan enemies of the nations of God's kingdom in the world today. I think that you can well understand that this is one of the problems, but when people say we're all about all done, let me tell you something. It's an easy thing for God to remove men and change and produce new leadership. That's a very simple thing for Him to do. And I'm absolutely confident that the peoples of America are rising and are awakening to produce that new leadership. I believe they're going to demand that leadership, and the destinies of God's nations are not about to be overcome by the hordes of darkness. We are about to see the greatest day in all human history when we are going to rise and shake off the power that seeks to bind us, and we're going to drive the thing which is evil out of our land, and we're going to lead nations to a great new destiny under God. That's God's purpose, and it's God's plan. And there isn't enough of the forces of darkness to change that order of events. Your heritage dates back into antiquity. It reaches back clear into the lineage of Adam. It goes back, my friends, into the whole line of civilization from this given point. In fact, some people who have been under the illusion that all races came from Noah or all the peoples of earth came from Adam overlook the fact that the genealogy traced to Adam is of great significance. Now, when tracing the genealogy of Christ, they take it all the way back to Adam. They don't stop anywhere at Noah. They keep right on going until they get it back to Adam, because there are other genealogies. And other genealogies are vain ones, and other genealogies have no position in the destiny which God hath purposed concerning the establishment of His kingdom. There is nothing that's more clear than what God has to say about this in the book of Matthew. Here in the book of Matthew, He says, one of the things I'm going to do, I'm going to come into the earth theater, I'm going to make this an advent, I'm going to suddenly gather before Me the nations of the world, and I'm going to divide the nations like a shepherd divides the sheep from the goats, and I'm going to say to the sheep nations, these peoples of Israel, now receive this kingdom which I prepared for you before the foundation of the world. And so under the very authority here with which God speaks, He ordains that the sheep nations, or the Israel nations, the white nations of the Western world, are going to rule the world under the leadership of incarnate and embodied deity. And He's going to make His power and His majesty seen from one end of the earth to the other. Now that, my friends, is His word, and I'd rather take that assurance than the promise of any politician on the face of the nation's history. Now, if you do not think that this is in a significant and important hour, let me tell you it is. Even still, inside of the captive circle of nations, many of which are of your own race stock, where nations like little Issachar or Finland captured and inside the maw of the Soviet system. And still remember that in those days before it went down under Count Mannerheim, it said, men of Issachar, stand and fight, and let the world know that nothing but scorched earth, cursed by Yahweh, shall fall into Russian hands. And then something rather significant. You know, one of the first things that Finland did when it made a retaliatory bombing raid way back there was to bomb Bibles written in Slavic tongues down on the peoples of along the borderlands of Russia. When they asked Mannerheim why he dropped Bibles instead of bombs, he said, we dropped Bibles to see if there was any seed left that might respond to them. And if there isn't any seed left, then, he says, it doesn't make any difference what we do. So you see, they knew who they were, and they were reaching for some possible redemptive seed, and before the little Finland defended itself with hard steel against the enemy in his homeland, they dropped the word in again. They never take this important impact of their background away from them. The significant thing today that Simeon Spain was to fulfill its prophecies, Anglo-Saxonism has been fulfilling their prophecies up to this great turbulent hour in which we live in. The Germanic peoples are fulfilling the great destiny of the house of Judah. They have been fulfilling that destiny through the years. One of the prophecies that related to them even concerned the fact that they would have in this climactic days a very powerful governor in one of their last cycles. He would enclose many peoples round about, and this did take place in your time. But in the climax of this age, when the enemies move against us and the nations of the world find themselves trying to save the tents of Judah first, You're going to discover, as the scripture said, that the peoples of Central Europe, the Germanic peoples, the Goths and the Ostrogoths, are going to be standing by the Anglo-Saxons and the Franks and the Normans in one great solid wall against oncoming communism. Why? Because God said, I'm going to take the stick of the house of Judah, Israel, his companions, and I'm going to take the stick in the house of Joseph and all the house of Israel, his companions, and I'm going to make them one stick, one battle axe, one warring power in my hands. And that's, my friends, what's going on today, and that's why today you have what we call the Eichmann trial. That Eichmann trial is a great propaganda warfare to try to divide and split and stir up troubles between the peoples of America and the peoples of Germany. And they're trying to take a new generation and sow into them the hate that has been so successfully organized by organized Jewry through the periods of the past. Someone says, well, terrible things happened, but we don't believe the things they have charged happened, because the 6 million dead they claim to have put to death in Germany under the charges of Jewry are walking the streets of America and Latin America, and there were more after the war than there was before the war, so very obviously they didn't die over there. The fact also remains that we should be thinking about this in this hour of turbulence, for there was no Israeli during that period, and they have no jurisdiction in this matter, and the whole court of nations as such, under a United Nations and under world approval, is turning their heads away and not recognizing the fact that international crime was committed here, and the sovereignty of nations without extradition treaties were violated, and that this whole thing is just a Canaanite show to try to split the world up. For the thing they are worried about is that the great Christian nations will forget the past propagandas and the dividing influences and stand shoulder to shoulder against the true great enemy of the Western world, which is the anti-Christian controlled forces of world communism at this time. There isn't any doubt that among our leaders they are talking about trying to stop the communists at Laos, and trying to stop the communists at South Vietnam, where they start up a new trouble and where it explodes now with great violence. But the way to stop it is to not only increase our strength, but to break the powers from the hands of the peoples of God's kingdom and set them free from the world government programs of Babylon and of the United Nations. And then, if we are to march to war, let us drop the bombs at Beiping and Moscow, and not, my friends, fool with the jungles of Laos. There never has been a period more important than this one concerning the things that are about to happen. You're on an alert right now. Everywhere they're on alert. In fact, you've been sending more flat tops out into the Pacific, and they have been telling those in key positions of responsibility concerning your great bomber fleets to stay close or immediate vicinity so that they can be in a plane at once, and they've been canceling leaves, and this thing is nip and tuck at any moment. And you're standing here in 1961 on the edge of one of the great and last climactic struggles of time. If you do not think that this is a significant period, let me tell you, the enemy is more worried about any thought that arises in your nation that proclaims these truths, or anything that arises in your nation that exposes the activities of the enemy, or anything that upholds constitutional Americanism or warns us about our trouble. I've been watching for the last 3 weeks this constant attack about on the John Birch Society. We've mentioned it several times in our Friday night meetings. This attack is coming from the same forces in the same area that attacked McCarthy and Senator Pat McCarran and Congressman Rankin and attacked any patriot anywhere in the country that raised his voice. The same forces that years ago started their smearing attack on Gerald Smith and turned their attention towards Connolly McGinley or towards any of the early writers concerning these situations are now turning their attack upon the so-called ultra-conservative organization known as the John Birch Society. I think it's rather significant to see the way this pressure is rolling out. I had an experience the other day on Thursday of talking with an editor from a newspaper in Santa Barbara. And he was starting to praise his city, and I said, I don't think that you should be quite so proud of that city after the fact that it gave the best reception that any city in America gave to Khrushchev. And any time a city can so embrace Khrushchev that it goes down in Russian history as the most hospitable city in America, and the mayor and the students from the university and some of the silly preachers all had to get out and pump his hand and gather around and he broke loose from those that were holding him, and he rushed out to embrace Santa Barbara. And Santa Barbara, where today we have left-wing influences and commies inside the schools and in our colleges there, and we can't get rid of them, and influence is being directed out of there to spread an entire liberal wing across the nation, took Mr. Khrushchev to heart. The bloody butcher from the Antichrist hordes of Russia, who had now Hungary's blood still on his hands. Well, the newspaper editor said, well, we just redeemed ourselves. We just supplied the authors in these newspapers that have exposed this terrible subversive John Birch Society. Well, I said, you're going right down the line scoring on the same side. Isn't it a strange thing that in this hour in which you live, that all this excitement can rise up and they want to bring great pressure, and all the newspapers, a lot of action on conservative, pro-America, anti-communist organizations. You don't see action among all these newspapers to do something about the communists in our schools, about the subversive factor that's already planning the conditions to bring about revolution, to sabotage law enforcement and food supply. You don't find the newspapers crying out against the great opening of the door to the danger of our people by the functions of our Treasury Department. Oh, you say, what did they do? I'll tell you one thing they did just 2 weeks ago. And now the Medical Association is beginning to explode. They opened up the nation to a outlet for Russia of disease and poison that could wipe out your great cities. We have, and have since some 10 years ago, an act passed by Congress against trading with slave states and receiving their goods. So any trade with Russia is trading with slave labor and slave states. And that's the way the Act of Congress so read. And that's the way it was intended to be interpreted. Our own fishermen have had a lot of problem in this country because our government subsidizes other countries, buys them fine fishing fleets, and puts canneries on them. Then if an American wants to buy one, he has to buy it with his own money, and he can't afford a cannery so good. So with the cheaper labor, Japan has been packing crab meat and seafood. It's been well packed. It's been done with the finest equipment, and they can sell it 20% less than you can sell yours on the American market. But now comes the news our Treasury is going to ship into us Russian crab meat 50% less than the Japanese, than the American market, which proves that if you can produce anything 30% less than the Japs, it is slave labor. Because nobody has a lower labor market and still be free than the Japs. Now, even more dangerous than the fact that the Treasury Department can just set aside an act of Congress and arbitrarily do as they please is the added danger of the fact now, as the Medical Association has brought it out, and 2 days ago your newspapers were carrying something else. The greatest laboratories on the face of the earth for germ warfare with deadly viruses and strange cultures and metabolisms and epidemics to sweep great cities that could wipe out whole cities is in the Soviet Union. And whereas we have laboratories like this in Colorado where we've been experimenting on counteraction and necessary germ warfare if we have to, the fact is that Russia has already been using it. And when she went into Tibet and took over the peoples of Lhasa, she moved them out into valleys and into villages for experimental use. And thousands of them, with the infection of one or two, were quickly swept away by the epidemics, and then to see whether it could be combated with any known science. They used their own masked doctors and equipped with even air taken in entirely from oxygen tanks and so forth, and they tried all the policies known to medical science to save the victims they had inoculated, and they died by the thousands. And the Dalai Lama reported this to India, and now even the illegitimate throne, now in fear and toppling, it's reported to India that the people of Tibet are being exterminated by the experiments in germ warfare by the Russians. In the meantime, while you're hearing all of the terrible conditions of the Eichmann case to frighten and to get America angry, you are fraternizing with the governments who are mass exterminating people today, not 20 years ago, or not just a story, but are doing it now with germ warfare in their laboratories. For you, they are preparing the same kind of germs. Now, what your doctors are worried about, and what every American should be worried about, and why he should boycott every bit of Russian goods, and why his congressman should be notified how he feels, is that all Russia has to do as she cans the crab meat, which is a moist food, is a few germs, a few metabolism, a few epidemic viruses, and seal the can. Maybe it's only one or two cans in a whole load of it, but that finally finds its way, and then the epidemic breaks out in one city, and it's untraceable.
And the medical association said, when you've got an enemy that wants to rule the world, when you've got an enemy without God, an enemy without conscience, an enemy who's already demonstrating that he will mass massacre a whole society for his experimental purposes, then that enemy can send his moist foods into your land, and you take them in while he still proclaims himself your enemy, then you're a whole lot more foolish than you should be. So this is the repercussion of the policy. And the Treasury Department said, we're only trying to implement Mr. Kennedy's policies. That's one of the reasons why you better have some knowledge about God's plans, because if you watch those policies, you would be beginning to lose hope that we would be able to survive. That's why I want to call your attention to something else. Whereas Dan Smoots has been circulating his material and contains some of it, the John Birch Society, in a lot of its meetings, brought this thing out and turned tremendous pressure loose on the Congress, and now they step it up a little higher. It's rather interesting when you find that members associated with the Jewish Helio Club were able to penetrate and double-cross and do spying operations inside the organization. And when you hear all the things that were said about that organization in the last few days, I think if you read them very closely, nobody has been over-alarmed. They're not as alarmed as they should be about organized groups of gangster communism in America, about their plans against your waterworks and their plans against your police department, their plans against your fire department, and the violence and the trouble and the slave camps and the strategy. It's there. Your own government knows it's there. Now, why should anybody try to play it down as the newspapers are? They say why students get alarmed. They say that there's even a secret organization of military leaders who are planning on helping to defend America. Is that a bad thing? I wish there was one so strong that we didn't have to worry that they would be strong enough to help the police at any zero hour anywhere, and we wouldn't have some of these riot threats that are in the offing. But the thing is, they are trying to make ridiculous the first discussion of the real danger that America's heard for a long time outside of the Christian nationalists and these areas, which they have tried to separate and isolate, but even that's failing. Now, all over the nation, we are discovering anywhere we go that at the grassroots, the people are beginning to wake up that there's a great menace and there's a great danger. And as they're waking up, they are looking for ways to join with other Americans to do something about it. And they are coming out of Methodist churches and Baptist churches and Presbyterian churches and other denominations. And they are thrilled with this knowledge that there is a relationship between the white race and its civilization and its culture and Christianity to the whole substance of their survival. When they say, it's thus saith the Lord, it makes a great change in the thinking of a people. I want you to pause for one moment while we think about these things. Don't be disturbed about what's going to happen. They're not going to be able to stop the truth. I wish they'd have an investigation. If they have an investigation and the facts all get out before all the people and they all find out what these facts consist of, there's going to be a lot of people that'll never have influence in America again. Because I can tell you that a whole lot of the things which they are charged with charging are true, and I can document them if they can't. I sat and listened inside of hearings in Washington to evidence of things which cropped out which are more deadly than I've heard any charge made concerning these officials that would betray. When I got through talking to this editor from Santa Barbara, who was worried about how many millions of dollars the Patriots were getting, and I just said, now, I said, after I painted these pictures and told him what the enemy was doing, aren't you glad somebody's getting some money to do something in the right direction? I said, I don't belong to this organization, but I'm for anybody that's going our way to save America, and we'll start activating the thing that God's going to use as a great instrument in his hand. And I'll tell you a little secret. Fellow said, well, everything's crooked. Politics is crooked. It's all crooked because the money system's crooked. And he says, you know, Dr. Swift, the trouble is the people that have the money. I says, who's got it? He says, the Jews and the gangsters. Well, I said, now you said it. Just remember that when you go away. It's what you said. And just remember that there's just one way then, if that's where all the trouble's coming from, is to save the trouble. That's to eliminate both of them by some process or another, which would be legal. Probably to lock up the gangsters and to deport the Jews on dual allegiance and get these enemies of Christ out of our country. Then I asked him this thing that is the important question to anybody. What are you doing about it? Did you use your editorial pages in the past to correct this thing you knew was wrong? Did you call anybody's attention to it? Someone says, well, I don't have a newspaper. No, but you've got a mouth and you can tell it. There isn't anything that you and I cannot look back on in the background of this long and ancient line of destiny and not only be thrilled with the way God has brought about your survival, but in the way this ancient culture has continued while the world was plunged into ignorance and darkness. There were universities in your race line, universities over the maps of Europe that were teaching the knowledge which God had unveiled to Enoch and Job, that knew mathematics, that knew calculus, trigonometry, geometry, just as they learned it in the ancient city of Heliopolis. Not, my friends, without mathematics, not without astronomy, not without a basic knowledge. And they knew how to read and write then. And I wouldn't be too surprised that the graduate of an English school of 2,000 years ago had a better education when he came out than if he came out of one of our modern progressive schools today. Because he could read, write, and multiply, and that's something you can't be sure they can do today. But it's not beyond their ability to recapture this. I want you to turn then for one passing thought, and it's in the book of Ephesians. It's here I read the vastness of God's grace as this Apostle Paul has been into the heavens and back again. Whether in the body or out of the body, he didn't know, but into the heavens and back again. That was the story of the Apostle Paul. And he said, blessed be this eternal Yahweh of our embodied Messiah, who hath blessed us with spiritual blessings in all heavenly places in his own being, and hath blessed us with him when he chose us before the foundation of the world and destined us that we were going to be in the earth holy, without blame, and before him in his love. Therefore, accordingly as he hath chosen us before the foundation of the world and set us this destiny, he predetermined that we would be positioned by himself according to the good pleasure of his own will in the earth to the praise of his glory, and he makes us utterly acceptable in the Spirit unto himself. In whom we not only have all redemption through his blood and forgiveness of our transgressions according to his riches and the riches of his grace, wherein he hath abounded toward us in all wisdom and in all prudence, having made known unto us the mystery of his will according to his own good pleasure, which he hath purposed in himself. And this includes that in the dispensation of the fullness of time, he's going to gather together in one, under one throne, under one power, and under the great and mighty law of heaven and his household, all the things that are in heaven and all the things which are in earth, even in him. And we have our inheritance already obtained and have already been predestinated by him to this purpose with him, to work out all things according to the counsel of his own will. Even the new version they have brought out is beautiful in its rendering of this masterful sovereignty of divine purpose. That every knee shall bow and every tongue shall proclaim that the eternal Yahshua is the eternal one. And they're going to know that you are Elohim. And they'll know that these children of El, whether they're called Anglish or whether they are called the sons and daughters of God, are one and the same.